everyone.
Welcome back to another episode of the Empathy Podcast. I'm Holly Custard.
And I'm Nelson Almanzar. Here at the Empathy Podcast, we bring on guests from all walks of life, and we talk about things like compassion, listening, and understanding, and how all these things have an impact on our lives.
That's right. And we get to share stories with our guests to talk about how empathy plays a positive role in our day-to-day. And we're happy to report that it happens a lot more frequently than we might think.
Yes. So before we begin this episode, we want to invite you to connect with us on our website, www.empathypodcast.com, and find us on Facebook and Instagram.
And if you like what you hear, please rate this podcast and share it with your friends.
Great. So thanks for listening. Now let's tune in to this episode of the Empathy Podcast.
Well, Gabe, you know, we were thinking about all of the work that you've done. It looks like for quite a while, you've been working in public affairs, government relations, doing lobbying work and consulting and policy advising, and also noted that you're the Senior Director of Policy and Public Affairs for the Board of Hispanic Caucus Chairs. And as we were looking through all of that work and your educational history of government and public policy, we're wondering if you could tell us about this. Like, how did you come to this work? And tell us a little bit about what you do and what a kind of a day in the life of a political consultant looks like.
Sure. And again, thank you for the invite to join y'all this morning. I think the focus of your podcast and the across industries for our society is one that we really need more than ever as we talk about a variety of different issues. But as it relates to myself, this was definitely not a life path or a profession that I contemplated early in life. I wasn't drawing pictures of myself in fourth grade as a lobbyist or a public policy nerd or anything like that. Back then, to make a very long story short, I was watching the senators debate this bill, and I became completely enthralled with the theater of politics, the conversations, the hot debates. And from that point, I realized that this was something that lit a fire within me, the likes of which I had never experienced before. So I immediately changed my major from psychology to government, and never looked back. So
on a day-to-day basis, I'm working on some element of public policy. And to a large degree, the focus of my work is looking at larger societal issues, whether it's within healthcare, education, economic development, workforce development, that type of thing, seeing how it impacts the general population, and then trying to understand and study how public policy solutions can affect those issues in a positive way. Taking the theory of whether it's healthcare policy or economic policy and looking at the real world implications of those things. But at the end of the day, my ability to affect change through public policy solutions can only come in my ability to interact with legislators, staff, advocacy groups, and the like. I think the first thing that comes to mind is some of the initiatives that we've engaged in with the Board of Hispanic Caucus Chairs. And for reference, that's an organization that serves as the umbrella organization for all the state Latino legislative caucuses. So across the country, we have a variety of different caucuses, whether subject matter caucuses, identity politics caucuses, that type of thing. And we're the national organization for all the Latino state legislative caucuses. And one of the things that we were able to do 2 years ago is in the wake of Texas's 2017 legislative session, when they passed very controversial legislation around both sanctuary cities and supporting immigrant communities by way of SB 4. It was something that, although it was completely Texas-centric, it had a lot of implications for other states looking to Texas as a model for things that they can implement in their own states. So trying to be proactive in that space, we engage in a national coalition building effort where we leverage our legislators in each of the states that we have representation in, as well as all the community stakeholder groups and advocacy organizations to create basically a national defense plan.
So what does that mean, like in the grand scheme of things? What is the impact of this legislation?
Well, here in Texas, and again, with any policy measure, you can really start delving into the rhetoric of it was good or bad, depending on your perspective. The impact, though, in Texas was that ultimately, in most objective voices would agree with this, it made our communities less safe, it made our communities less inclusive,
and less inviting for our immigrant brothers and sisters just across the board. And we didn't want to see that replicated in other states. Because if you have a situation where part of SB 4 was involves a requirement that local and county law enforcement would need to work in greater concert with federal immigration forces in terms of detainment orders and other work they're doing in those communities, which to a large degree creates a larger division and separation from local law enforcement and immigrant communities they may be working. And in a time where we're trying to promote more community policing priorities and best practices as it relates to interacting with residents at a community level, if you're law enforcement, that made it really difficult and really took a hit to the trust that was trying to be built here in Texas communities from local law enforcement and immigrant communities. So as a response to that, we engaged in a national plan to combat that from happening in other states. So our caucus members, our advocacy groups, and a lot of other champions on this issue went back in the subsequent sessions that they were going in either later in 2017 or in this year and laid the groundwork to ensure that this didn't happen in their states. And despite the complexities of politics across different states and regions, very happy to know that because of the hard work of our legislators and community stakeholders, we have been able to stop those types of discriminatory practices pop up in other states.
It's so interesting. I was just thinking about, you're saying so much of your work is building and maintaining relationships because it's through those relationships that you're able to achieve all of this type of work. And it seems like a very complex, it's obviously a complex issue. And, you know, I'm thinking that there's different levels of understanding that goes into finding the right solution. So looking at the perspective from the communities themselves, from the law enforcement, from the government actors, businesses, there's so many different people, you know, how do you engage with people who have differing perspectives on the issue? And how do you engage their voice either in trying to achieve your objective or trying to convince or show a new way of looking at something in order to achieve your goal? How do you incorporate all of these different perspectives on this issue, which is emotional and, you know, difficult for people to, I guess, talk about? How do you facilitate that?
You know, it can be tough. And it really comes down to who's facilitating that type of engagement, right? For someone like me, where if I have my political nonprofit hat on, I'm trying to find as many supporters as I can to lift up our position on this issue. So although there are a variety of different perspectives, I personally am probably not trying to find the opposing voices and lift those voices up in a way that could harm our efforts in trying to create more inclusive communities. That doesn't mean I don't seek them out, because I think it's extremely important when you're working on very complex policy issues like this one to understand all perspectives, so that you can retool your strategies, knowing what is being said, what's being thought, what's being felt on the other end of this issue. I think that's a really important piece of it. But part of it is it helps to have a general background in these types of issues. So you go into these things kind of already knowing where most camps live, right? I can talk about the idea of sanctuary cities or forcing local law enforcement to work in concert with ICE. And I could tell you, even before we start having preliminary conversations, for the most part, where most advocacy groups, most industry associations, and most legislators are going to fall on this. But part of it is ensuring that you try to lift up the voices that are going to help support your cause and find ways as much as possible to neutralize the voices and perspectives that are harmful to it. But that's the element of policymaking, right? So when we're trying to deliberate on these issues, pass these bills at a committee to get into the chamber and then over to the other chamber, that deliberative process is all about hearing and understanding different perspectives. And that's the essence of committee.
How do you know you're making progress? And what does that look like in terms of making one side of the table feel heard? What activities, what's happening there?
So I'm going to focus these responses more from a legislative or policymaking standpoint, because I think it provides a little more applicability in real-world examples. that comes in two different ways when you're talking about just understanding everyone's perspective. There's a formal and the informal. So by way of the formal, it's very much what I was alluded to before through traditional committee hearings. And if you've never had the pleasure or displeasure, depending on the particular issue, of sitting through an entire committee hearing at the state legislative level on an issue, please do. They're extremely fascinating. And they're fascinating because you see a wide array of people coming and taking time out of their schedules to come testify on a particular issue. And it's everything from the president, some big CEO, some large company, or a resident of the state who literally just wants to come and voice their opinion on this issue for these legislators. And it's fascinating to hear the different perspectives, different opinions. And in many times, you hear different issues that are brought up within these hearings that on the surface may not have anything to do with the bill, but for that person, this is what this piece of legislation makes them feel. And their testimony may go off on this wide tangent. And many people are in the room kind of looking around like, what is this guy talking about? But the reality is this issue makes them feel certain ways and brings up all these other ancillary issues to the forefront for them. And it's important to understand that. So you get that, you get a lot of that during that formal interaction. Informally, if you're trying to engage in policymaking, I think it's essential to garner those different perspectives on an issue by having direct conversations, setting up stakeholder meetings, having site visits, doing whatever you need to talk to all voices. And because I think regardless of the issue, you got to have a conversation with your known opposition. Most people know going into, especially if it's a controversial issue, going into a legislative battle, if they're going to have opposition, it's usually a great strategy to try to engage in a dialogue with whatever those opposing voices might be before the legislative process kicks off. So you can understand their position better and trying to find ways to accommodate that as much as you can while still trying to achieve your objective.
Well, it seems like that makes, you know, having that opportunity, especially in the hearings, like to have that personal connection with different people's perspectives, it kind of feels like it emotes a feeling, like you're resonating with someone's emotions more. So that sounds a lot like empathy to me. And I'm wondering, like, does that personal connection and those personal stories, understanding that background, does empathy, you know, that kind of approach, does it shape policy? How does it impact it ultimately?
So I think the personal story is a huge part of the policymaking process. In order to try, especially if you're trying to take a legislator and get them to change their perspective on an issue, want to shift their paradigm on a particular topic, it helps to root those arguments in a personal story, specifically one that can resonate with them. That's how you're going to be able to move the needle through empathy. The challenge when it comes to legislating or policymaking, is that empathy, although a very powerful force in the decision-making process, is just one of many factors that go into that decision for a particular legislator. And it's especially pervasive on the state and federal level, where you have so many different factors that go into one vote on an issue, whether it's a member on a committee that needs to vote to get this bill out of hearing, or out of the committee to the chamber, or it's an actual floor vote on a bill on the House floor or on the Senate. There's so many different things that go into that decision, whether it's the view of their constituents. How is this going to pull back to in something that's not as publicly spoken by way of these legislators, but something that we all know is an influence? Any of the positions of some of their large donors? How do some of my big three campaign donors feel about this particular issue or this particular vote? And then there's also the personal aspect. How do I personally relate to this specific issue? And how does it impact me on a day-to-day basis? And that's where empathy really can play a big role. If you're able to shift the paradigm for a lot of opposing voices by appealing to empathetic arguments, that can really help move the needle. But it is just one of many factors that go into the ultimate decision.
What types of skills prepared you in your university instruction? Was it deliberate, this kind of focus on effective communication strategies and empathy and compassion? And you know, these kinds of things that Nelson and I are always interested in talking about. Is it a skill that you kind of, you have implicitly in you? People are drawn to this field because they have it. It's something you're born with, or did you learn it?
So for the first part of that, as relates to the education background, both for undergrad and my graduate studies, empathy is definitely not a large part of the public policy discipline or public affairs for public education. It's very much centered on the theory. It's very theory-based, but it's also from a practitioner lens. How do we most, especially on the public administration side, how do we most effectively execute a public policy or regulation through the channels of government? It's almost, to a degree, devoid of empathy. Mm-hmm. You're really talking about, you know, the theories of healthcare policy. You're talking about the theories of economic development, how to spur a workforce creation. And in those conversations with and lectures and study material, very rarely is there a subsection. And that subsection is, and how does this impact people? So I think to a degree, it's not necessarily intertwined within traditional disciplines that is taught at a university level. I believe it really should be more. It should be more present in the classroom as it relates to policymaking, because at the end of the day, these are pieces of legislation that will ultimately affect people and their lives. So removing the human component, I think, can be very detrimental to the overall process. For me personally, I had the unique experience of being the product of a military family. So my dad was Army officer until about 20 years ago. And because of that, I was born in Wiesbaden, Germany, spent 8 years there, and then proceeded to move around the country every 2 years. So within that, I was exposed to a wide array of different communities, different backgrounds, different perspectives, and different kinds of people. And it wasn't until, honestly, until I got back to Texas, that where my family has roots, and we'd always spend our summers in San Antonio. But it wasn't until I got back to Texas that I started to realize many of the divisions that are present in most people's communities and most people's societies. Because for me growing up, it was always surrounded by the military community. And it was diverse, full of different racial backgrounds, ethnic backgrounds, religious beliefs, and the like. And the common thread was, oh, we're all in this together as military personnel and family. And I didn't see those differences to a large degree and was able to be exposed to many different lifestyles that allowed me, I think to a large degree, it opened up my own personal lens to being open to other people's positions on issues later in life, because I had such great exposure to different kinds of people growing up. So I don't think that's necessarily something that I was born with.
But we're starting to see in business that companies are becoming more human-centered. They're doing activities such as design thinking. They're putting the experience of the customer ahead of profits. How does that have a place within government and policymaking?
So I think especially with the changing dynamics of the way we communicate, the way we interact, the rise of social media and the like, our legislators at the state and federal level are way more exposed to their constituencies than they ever have been before. I think, you know, prior to the changing tech landscape of the mid-2000s, a lot of legislators were able to operate almost in a silo, where the only updates their constituents and their districts would be in newsletters they would put out, or town hall visits, or if you're a very actively engaged voter, because you would actually go to the state house and try to understand what your elected representative was doing. Because of the rise of social media and digital communication, these legislators are way more exposed in terms of their day-to-day actions. So whether it's a vote on an issue, passes of a resolution, whatever it is, that vote will be amplified throughout their district, and their constituents will have a better understanding of what they're doing in Austin, if we're talking about Texas, on their behalf. So because of that, I think to a large degree, there's a greater emphasis put on the optics. And I think very much like your business analogy, we can talk about what's the intent, what is the what's driving this type of more consumer-focused action? Is it because of the genuine goodwill of these companies? Or is it because it is a helpful tool as it relates to marketing and community relations? Mm. And I think, you know, by dissecting the intent is not necessarily something that we need to do, because at the end of the day, the effect is what's really important. But I think it's the same thing for these legislators, right? So whether or not they actively care about every single person in their district is one thing, but they are definitely showing that they do more, because they have to. At the end of the day, they all want to come back to office next election cycle. The only way to do that is to maintain favor with the majority of their voting constituents. And in a world where their actions as a duly elected representative for this district is more exposed and more amplified than ever before, they need to be even more cognizant of how those votes, how those positions on certain issues will play back. And before, I think it was a little easier for people to have more dynamic views on issues, not worrying about the impact back home, because voters, to a large degree, were less engaged because there was less information. But because there's more information now, there's a higher importance placed on the optics of every decision.
Have you ever worked on an issue where something got totally derailed because there wasn't enough focus on the community and the needs of the community or the perspectives that they held, where, I don't know, maybe it's a misunderstanding or maybe it's not enough due diligence? Or is there an example of something that kind of got derailed because of lack of empathy?
It's good to preface this, Dana, by saying that empathy does not just relate to some of the bleeding heart issues that we can all sit around and say, oh yeah, this is a good feeling issue that we all should have certain feels about. Everybody feels a certain way about a certain issue, regardless of whether or not we agree with their position on them. And I think that's something that we saw play out on a national scale in 2016 during the presidential election. And it's something that I think was made very apparent in the voter outreach and engagement in the Rust Belt, where you had a Democratic Party who traditionally had relied on a big swath of Democratic voters in that part of the country, but to a large degree over the course of the last few cycles, lost touch with the position of certain elements of those communities and lost that empathetic lens as it related to the impact of globalism and the way that we were evolving as a U.S. economy. It was something that was, for many and many Democratic pundits and political consultants would agree, that was put on the back. This is not the issue that's going to get us voted into office. We don't even necessarily worry about the small amount of jobs that are being lost in the industrial sectors. We need to focus on the future moving forward. But in that, there was a lack of empathy with some of these people who were losing jobs due to the effects of globalization. I think that everyone on this call right now can all agree that overall, the effects of globalization and more of a global economy is a net benefit for most people. But in this one specific example, it was a detriment to a small population of voters who felt like their position on this particular topic, their experiences were not being heard by a specific party. And what happened was they gravitated to the person who was talking to them, directly to them, and talking about that they empathize with them. I understand how you feel when you lose your job to an outsourced operation in Indonesia, wherever it might be. And because of that, there was enough of a swing in that block of voters in the states across the Rust Belt that really changed the political map and the dynamic and ultimately got us where we are today with our sitting president.
So how do we, you know, really interesting thinking about the impact definitely politically and wondering now, you know, with this divisive kind of situation in the US and other countries, you know, get so many people being polarized on different issues. How do we, I guess, outside of politics, but connected to it, how do we get, what do you think is essential for people, whether advocates for a particular issue or just as citizens in a community, you know, how do we develop new points of view? How do you see other people's perspectives that are different from your own in order to find common ground? I mean, it seems like everybody's kind of struggling with how to do that. especially during the midterm elections, you know, how do we reach across the aisles to really talk about what's important about issues and advocate for the greater good? Like, I guess in your line of work, how would you recommend people to build that skill? How do you do that?
You know, I would say in our current climate and the world that we live in today, it is probably harder than ever before to be open to different perspectives. It's the same trip that we always go to where, you know, in the information age, we have more access to information and more opportunities to connect with people. We're actually becoming more insulated in our own thinking and just using these outlets as a way to surround ourselves with like-minded people. So it's a challenge because I think we all, through whether it's our digital communities or our physical social circles, we tend to insulate ourselves with people who are like both in values and position on certain issues. It's tough to on a day-to-day basis interact with folks who are so opposed on certain issues or don't share certain values in a way that can lead to genuine interactions. I think it's really tough in this day and age, but I think that the tools are there. We just have to be willing to use them. And I would suggest to anyone that wanted to do that and everyone that should, to have conversations, to actively and openly seek out people who you know are diametrically opposed on certain issues. Maybe they look completely different from you. They live in a different part of the state. It's your crazy cousin who is a conspiracy theorist. You know, whatever it might be, although those conversations can be very uncomfortable and a lot of times emotionally charged, I think it's extremely important to have real and genuine conversations with people who are different in their values and perspective on issues. That is the only way that we can start to learn from each other. And I'll go further as to say that it's especially challenging in the United States in the sense that although nationally we're a very diverse country, we're not a very inclusive country. And we are still to a large degree highly segregated as a nation. So it's difficult if you grow up in a predominantly Black community to know what it's like for a Honduran immigrant if you've never met one. And you don't know that, you know, there's a lot of things that are similar by way of the struggles of our people that I should, in an ideal world, support you in these. Or if you are in a predominantly White community and you may struggle to think of any Black person you even know. It's tough to think about the legacy of civil rights, and how we got here, and some of the racial disparities that still exist in our world, because you have no connection with that. And so in light of the fact that our communities to a degree are still very segregated, it takes a concerted effort to want to seek out people who are different than you in order to learn from their perspectives and their life experiences. And I think that is what will lead to more objective thinkers and allow people to be more open to the idea of empathy to someone who may be polar opposite.
It's like we need a Facebook for people who think differently than ourselves.
Right.
We need to learn the skills, right?
The anti-bubble. We need an anti-Facebook bubble.
Well, it's funny because the way Facebook, I think, generally speaking, it's designed to show you things you like, right? The more you click on a certain person or a topic, you know, if you like kittens and you hit like a certain times, you're going to get more kittens, right? In your feed. And this just sort of feeds itself with like-minded thought, agreeable scenarios that you're just going to strengthen that point of view. And it takes work. It takes, over time, you start to understand like, oh, these are people too. And they have their reasons why they think a certain way or that they believe in a certain thing. And it's just knowing that, just even though you may not agree with it at the end, and that's not the goal, it's just understanding why a certain person thinks or behaves or a certain way. And that's more than enough to get progress moving forward.
Well, and Gabe, you mentioned too, I thought it was really interesting, your experience with a military family, like growing up among, you know, diverse people because of the military. Nelson, I know you're in the military too. Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting to think about what other kind of institutions, you know, if we're not self-selecting into diversity, I mean, the military is a great example, and maybe, you know, going to university where you have lots of different people from around the world studying and learning together, what other I guess, facets of society bring people together like that?
We're at a point where you have to self-select into diversity to really be exposed to different perspectives and backgrounds. The communities we all grow up in aren't necessarily highly inclusive or highly diverse, depending on where you are. If you're in New York City, there's no way you are not exposed to a myriad of diversity every day in the population there. But if you're in, say, for example, where I went to high school in Harker Heights, Texas, it's not very diverse. I think I was the only Latino kid in my neighborhood, for sure, and maybe one of 15 in the entire high school. So it was not very diverse. So if someone had some perspective on Latino issues, I was probably their anchor for that. And I don't know if I'm a great representative for the entire community as it relates to that. But I think although it can be another point of division, one area you do see opportunities for inclusion is both in community events that go outside of your neighborhood, citywide stuff. I really draw in different neighborhoods together for one thing. And the one that's, again, probably more divisive right now than it is unifying is in the backdrop of religion. But although, for the most part, you see a lack of racial diversity in a lot of different congregations across the country, there is an opportunity where, in many ways, you can find a common ground through your shared faith with someone who doesn't look like you, didn't grow up in the same part of the country as you, may not even speak the same language. But that common thread of faith is something that can open up a lot of people's eyes on some very contentious issues. But outside of that realm, it is very tough to find a specific institution or an opportunity to engage in diversity when that may not be something you've grown up with or something that you don't have a background in.
So how, you know, thinking about political consulting and lobbying work, you know, how can you tell us how you feel the impact of lobbying? What does it have for the benefit of the public, including what we're talking about, right? It seems like politics is a great place to bring people together too, ironically. I mean, given all the divisiveness right now, but how does the lobby do good in benefiting the public? How does this type of work make an impact?
So I would say that, you know, it can be an essential component of sound policymaking if done in the right way. I understand that to many people that the profession itself and the practice of lobbying can take on a very negative connotation, can have a kind of a bad reputation. And a lot of that comes from the type of lobbyists that operate rather unscrupulously and on behalf of industries that maybe don't have the public benefit or the public good in mind. But at the same time, you have lobbyists that their sole mission in life is to use their network, their skill sets, and their knowledge to advance the priorities of some tremendous organizations who their only mission is public good, public benefit. And through that, you can have a very positive effect on society if you're working on issues that will benefit society. Because at the end of the day, the only difference between lobbying and advocacy is the act, where you have advocacy, which is educating lawmakers and staff on specific issues. But why are those advocates educating those lawmakers on that specific issue? It's in order to hopefully engender a specific position for them. The only extra step the lobbyist takes is to make the specific ask. Now that you know all this, can you vote no on this bill? Can you vote yes on this measure? That's the only difference to a large degree. But I think lobbyists and other political consultants who work on the policy side can have a major effect if they try to focus their life, not necessarily on things that will help bring in revenue for their own self to pay the mortgage and the like, but instead focus their time and energy on stuff that they're passionate about, stuff that can have a public good, so that when I go to the Texas Capitol, I'm there representing an organization who's trying to create greater access to healthcare, or I'm there trying to represent a client who is trying to increase the resources and funding for special education students, or one that is trying to and provide more inclusive communities for immigrant families. that's the real life work of a lobbyist on a day-to-day basis. And basically, you as a consultant can choose which projects you work on. And through the projects that you're engaged in, you can hopefully use your skills and your contacts and your relationships to advance measures that are going to have spillover effects for all types of communities and really have a net benefit for society. I've always been more of a political optimist in that we have the ability as a society, as a American populace, to seek the ideals that many of us feel like it is possible, to try to represent the values that we all espouse as American virtues and do so in a way that is objective and available to all types of people. So I try to come at it with a lens of optimism. I will say that has been more difficult over the last few election cycles, given the type of divisive rhetoric I've seen populate, especially at a state and local level. It has become very partisan. It has become very nasty, very vitriolic in terms of the language we use and the divisions that we're creating. And in a time where we're supposed to be more connected than ever before, we're actually more divided than ever before because we are allowing ourselves to become insulated within our own social media bubbles, our own news media biases, and only filter information that speaks to our narrative and quickly dismiss anything that is opposed to that. So I do believe that in the short term, the nature of politics is going to continue to be very divisive. The future for this country as it relates to politics is engagement. It's going to be very easy for legislators and candidates, rather, to speak to the worst end of their partisan fringes. If we still have sub 30% voter engagement in a midterm election, it's very easy for Democrats to only speak to the most progressive end of their base and for Republicans to only speak to the most conservative end of their base.
So we got to get the people in the middle, the critical mass.
Yes. Without a doubt. I think you can speak to most objective people and they will agree that a more moderate view on most issues is the best approach. If we get more of those voters engaged, that's going to change the dynamic considerably. And this is a more of a personal mission. I espouse the virtues of drawing more competitive districts. I am definitely not a fan of partisan gerrymandering, nor am I a fan of partisan politics in general. I'm probably one of the most centrist Latino politicos you'll ever meet because I do believe in the values of positions on both sides. The only way that we're going to force legislators to try to speak to a more moderate audience and reach out to every segment of their district is with competitive districts, which I do not think we're going to get in our lifetime. I think people who are drawing the lines are really comfortable drawing the lines, relinquish that power. But in spite of that, the way to combat that is to make sure we have more voter engagement. So you have different voices, more people involved in the process, so that legislators can't sit back and only talk to the fringes of their party. They have to speak to everyone. That is going to be something that can change drastically the landscape of politics in this country.
Yeah, this is super insightful. Thank you so much for sharing your time and your expertise. And it's gotten me thinking about a few things. And I'm definitely going to start thinking about engagement because I think it's like the story for me, the end of the story is we've got to engage more locally. You know, we got to engage with more diverse ideas and diverse people locally so that we can understand and see the issues from different perspectives so we can make better choices, become better people overall.
Yeah, I have a similar takeaway. It's being willing to have the uncomfortable moment or the uncomfortable conversation or be in that space where it's not exactly everything that aligns with you and be welcoming and embracing it. So whether that's in whatever socioeconomic space or even something different, I think that we have to learn how to work that muscle of being open-minded and willing to listen and understand in order to gain a better perspective.
Yeah, and through that, we'll stop making assumptions about what motivates people on a specific issue. We can actually learn, you know, what drives their decisions on certain things. You know, I would just want to thank the two of you for the opportunity to come and visit with you on this issue. I think the work that you're doing with this podcast is extremely admirable. I think that, as I opened up with, empathy is something that is lost in many industries, but is definitely something that is lost in objective policymaking and something that we need more of. So I appreciate the attention that you've put on it as it relates to my work in Texas.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Empathy Podcast. Be sure to visit our website at www.empathypodcast.com. And if you have any questions, thoughts, or suggestions, feel free to send us an email at hello@empathypodcast.com. Also, find us on Facebook by searching Empathy Podcast, and be sure to tune in for the next episode.